Oscar Wayne. During this hour, we'll continue our conversation about trauma and recovery, going beyond large-scale disastrous events and also exploring more common types of personal trauma. And we want to hear from you, your stories of recovery and healing after adversity. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499 to share your stories. Joining us here in the studio are Drs. Linda Welsh and Sandra Bloom. Bloom is a psychiatrist with Drexel University School of Public Health, and she is a past president of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies and author of Creating Sanctuary Toward the Evolution of Sane Society. Sandra Bloom, thank you so much for being here.
Nice to be here, Micah.
We're also joined by Dr. Linda Welsh. She is a therapist and the director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd. In addition, Dr. Welsh is a clinical associate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And Linda Welsh, let me start with you. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, you hosted and facilitated a support group for families who had lost loved ones in the attacks. How did that come about?
Well, the Red Cross actually began recognizing that there was a lot of services provided in New York City, but there were also a lot of families here whose children were, or parents or relatives were living in New York and working at the World Trade Centers, and they had no real support system here, nothing organized. So they began this group for family members, children, parents, siblings of those who were lost.
And how did you met in the evenings, correct?
We met one evening a week.
And what were those evenings like? What were some of the most pressing topics, and how did it change over time?
Well, it was extremely powerful, because I'm a firm believer that their ability to reach out to each other, to share, mostly it was sharing memories of their loved ones, that gave meaning, that helped them get through the times. They supported each other. They loved each other. Basically, by the as the group evolved, the connections and friendships became very close. Even though they were quite diverse, both in age and in background, the commonality was, of course, what had happened to them on 9/11, and that brought them together. Most of the time was spent sharing photographs, poetry, memories, and coping skills, how each one of them found different ways to deal with the grief. And when one would be up, the other would be down, and they kind of held on to each other in that way.
Was there a difference because this was such a public grieving process?
Most definitely. It was at times useful because they realized the world was recognizing the losses they'd experienced. And of course, as we know, isolation, especially after trauma, can be absolutely devastating when you feel like you're the only one in the world who knows what it's like to lose a loved one. On the other hand, there were times when the media coverage was too much and too overwhelming, and very much a distraction from the personal grieving, and they felt an invasion in their privacy. So it would vary from event to event.
And Sandra Bloom, what were you thinking about as the events of 9/11 happened? In terms of the mental health of the country, what were some of your thoughts and concerns?
I was a long way from home. I was in Tampa, Florida, when it happened, and I was talking about trauma to a large group. And I had just gotten to the point where I was describing to people that if something terrible, I mean, really, this really happened, if something terrible happened right now, you wouldn't be able to pay attention to me, and we would all be focused on the trauma. And I noticed people walking in the back of the room on cell phones, and usually I can get people to pay attention for at least at 9:15 in the morning. They're still awake, and it was very disturbing. I saw that I must need to give people a break, and that's when we heard about it. And I think, like everybody else, my first concern was how was I going to get back home to my loved ones. And then once I was home and things started to clear, it was, I do a lot of work in New York, and a lot of people I knew had people who had had been involved directly in the tragedy. And so it became, for a little while at least, I think, a sense of a united community pulling together. And that's what Linda was referring to, is trying to help people after a traumatic event experience a sense of community with other people, and that really helps people to heal. And for a while, at least, I think as a country, we had that. For a little while, we had that sense of we really are all one. And that's a fundamental part of healing, I think, is knowing that you're not alone.
And we seek that community. I think in hour one, we heard an interview with the head of student counseling at Virginia Tech. And those students wanted to stay on campus. They didn't want to leave. So we seek that out.
You want to be around somebody who gets it. You want someone to be able to look at you. And that's how this group was. And know, without even having to explain it, what you're going through. One of the most powerful experiences I had was when we went into New York for memorial service. And we'd walk into a restaurant, and we with the Red Cross had some identification tags on us. So it was almost immediate that the people in the restaurant, the staff, and customers recognized who we were, came over to us and said, "Are you folks family survivors?" And we said, "Yes, we've brought them back to New York City to visit Ground Zero." Well, from then on, it was unity, it was free food, it was care, it was the utmost in kindness. And no matter where we went, we were quickly identified as being direct survivors of that tragedy. And the love that surrounded the families and the giving, people couldn't do enough to recognize what they had been through. And you rarely see that, you know, when a family is grieving. Communities come together in kind of a traditional way, but not with that spontaneity that we found in New York City.
And Sandra Bloom, what happens when we don't have a community? I was thinking, for example, about post-Katrina, where people were just dispersed and their community was no longer there. So what happens then?
Yeah, it's pretty devastating. I mean, I think we evolved as a way of working through our grief by having rituals, by having the support, that kind of kindness Linda's talking about from other people. And when that's absent, or when you are torn away from the people who you depended upon, what it can lead to is that someone does not complete the grieving process and they stay stuck. They stay stuck in time, often reenacting a traumatic experience in some way over and over again.
How so? What do you mean reenacting?
Well, literally sometimes creating scenarios where the same thing happens over and over again. One of the founding stories of the traumatic stress field is of a soldier from Vietnam who had gone through a terrible incident in which a close friend of his was killed, and he had to kill the person. And he repeated as an anniversary effect, but this time it was a robbery back stateside. And it's a very interesting story, but it typifies what happens to people, that they often will reenact in some very thinly veiled often way. The way children reenact traumatic experiences, often through play and through their behavior. They will, but it's not just children, grown-ups do that too. But it's often misidentified. We don't see that people are, by their symptoms, signaling that they need our help. Instead, we tend to label that behavior as bad.
But why do we do that? Because it is familiar, or because we're... What's the coping mechanism behind it?
There's probably a lot of reasons behind it. But I happen to think that the reason we do that is that we're signaling out to our community that we need help in order to recover and in order to complete the grieving process. And when we don't get that response, that kind of, it's a call, and when we don't get the response, then we have to keep doing it over and over again, to keep trying to signal out to our group that we're not okay, we're not whole, we haven't put all this together, we can't move on.
That's Sandra Bloom. She is a trauma expert, and with Drexel University, Linda Welsh is also a trauma expert and hosted a support group for families of 9/11 victims. So what happened as time went on? How long did the group of families stay together?
Oh, several years, and they still continue to get together to meet, maybe in less formal way, but keep contacts, depending on the personalities. I just wanted to add to something that Sandy had said, which is that the coping skills will often depend on their prior history with trauma, as she mentioned. And if you've had ways in the past to deal with loss, or you've been exposed to loss and you've found things that helped, you've turned to religion, you've turned to others, you've turned to traditional rituals, you've turned to violence in return, you tend to use those coping skills which worked before over again. The nice thing about the group was they got to teach each other what maybe some new ways, maybe some more productive ways to deal with giving meaning to what happened, rather than just relying on some of their own individual histories to reenact the situation.
And did you see in this group a lot of anger? I mean, people must have been angry.
Again, it varied depending on the pre-trauma personality. There were people who were very angry and who felt that we needed to do something as a country quickly for revenge. And then there were people who were set on doing something as a memorial to show the sadness and the grief. And I think that had to do with the personalities that they came into this situation with. So they were already kind of programmed. And that's why the group experience was nice. It could kind of shape new behaviors, which they maybe not had thought about prior to that, or wouldn't have thought about if they'd been alone in their grief.
And did one do better than the other? We often tend to think that anger is a very bad coping mechanism. Can that help people too?
Well, certainly their ability to express it in the group and get a kind of listening support without having to act it out, I think, was very important. Just to be able to say, I am still enraged, and have people listen and understand rather than be punitive or, you know, negative about what they were feeling, just to tell the story, which I think is what we call debriefing. There was a lot of debriefing. There was a lot of where were you when you heard, how did you find out about your son, and the chance to tell the story over and over again, which I think allowed some of the anger to be kind of watered down and then to be used in more constructive ways than just walking around angry and self-destructive in some instances.
And we can talk more about debriefing after our break, because that's one topic that was done a lot after 9/11 and now has fallen somewhat out of favor. We're talking about trauma and recovery, not just in context of 9/11, but in general. Joining us here in the studio are Drs. Linda Welsh and Sandra Bloom. Bloom is a psychiatrist with Drexel University School of Public Health, and Linda Welsh is the therapist and the director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd. More on Radio Times after our break. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, featuring hand-knotted rugs made by fairly paid adults. Online at rugs.10000villages.com. 10,000 Villages. Quality you desire. Fairness artisans deserve.
On September 11th, an NPR News special, coverage of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for memorial services from Ground Zero, the Pentagon, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We'll also report on how the day is being remembered around the country. That's special coverage from NPR News, the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Sunday morning, starting at 8 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKT, a luxury crossover with three rows of seats, a refrigerated console, and an available dual headrest entertainment system. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM. Or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast. And you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscoway, and we're talking about trauma and recovery, and we're going beyond large-scale disastrous events and also want to explore more common types of personal trauma. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Share your thoughts on the 9/11 anniversary or on your personal stories of healing and recovery after adversity. Joining us here in the studio are Doctors Linda Welsh and Sandra Bloom. Bloom is a psychiatrist with Drexel University School of Public Health, and Linda Welsh is a therapist and the director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd. And Sandra Bloom, before our break, we were starting to talk about something that was called, or is called, debriefing. And we heard a lot about that in the post 9/11 world, where especially first responders were asked to do debriefing sessions. What is that?
It is the opportunity to, in a very structured and formalized way, to give everyone information about what they may expect after a traumatic event, and to give them an opportunity to talk about what they feel and what their experience has been like with other people. There's a lot of controversy about it. I think probably because there have been times when debriefing has been used in a very mechanical kind of way, as if you could just go in and jimmy with a machine. And of course, it's relational. No matter what we do, it's still a relationship, and not everybody is ready to talk at the same time. Not everybody is ready to talk with other people. Not everybody wants to feel that they are in any way controlled, particularly after an experience where they haven't had any control at all. And so it's probably not so much that people don't need to debrief after a traumatic event, but the way it's done and how systematically it's done and how much respect is shown to individuals in the process.
And Linda, given that this is such a deeply personal response, that each individual is different in how they respond, how can you then devise a bigger response that could help a lot of people? Is it just to be there in case people need you, or what helps?
Well, I think what we recognize helps is that everybody is an individual, that some people will move quickly and be willing to revisit the experience. But mostly that you need to track them. You need to watch what the timing is according to that individual. So the kindest thing you can do is allow them the freedom to do it at their own time. It's not necessarily to get rid of the symptoms, although people may come into my office and say, you know, I'm having flashbacks, I'm having anxiety, I'm having stress, I want to get rid of the symptoms. And of course, that's the goal. But there's no quick fix to do it. And everyone moves differently in different ways. So to give them the space to tell the story as they are willing to, and to keep checking in and saying, now, how are you feeling as you're talking about it? And are things lessening? Are they easing? And are you ready, perhaps, to go back to the scene if it's an individual situation where you were traumatized, or are you ready to even imagine it in your head? It's a conversation. It's not a fix. And I think that's what's really important. The uniqueness of the individual and how they want to talk about it has to be considered.
And Sandra, you've said before that this can be a lifelong journey, and it can look differently at different stages in your life.
Yes, it's like any other important experience. A traumatic experience changes your life. It puts you into a different direction. It has a whole new set of experiences, that go along with it. So how, you're going to have to integrate that over and over again as you go through different life steps, as you go through different kinds of losses in your life. This stuff is going to kind of crop up again, like other things do. Every time we have a loss, it opens up the whole kind of doorway to the losses we've had in the past. That's not necessarily bad. It's really whether or how the person really copes with that. And denying it is probably not what you want to do.
But on some level, it feels like a life sentence of sorts. It feels like there's something that happened that has now altered my path forever. And yesterday, the young Marine I spoke to for the first hour program, Tony Ricosi, he came here to the station to drop off some photos to use for the website. And he said, you know, I just want to go back to where I was before. Mm. I just want to go back, and I can't. Mm-hmm. So do you first have to accept that before you can go anywhere?
Yeah, I think that that's part of the transformative aspect of it, is how do you channel that pain and sorrow into something that has meaning and purpose? And that can take different people, different ways to do that. But I think the people that thrive the most after a trauma have found something to do with those feelings and with that loss and the grief and the overwhelming nature of the experience that helps them, and usually that also helps other people. Judy Herman called it a survivor mission. And finding that survivor mission, I think, is pretty critically important for anybody that's a survivor.
I think the point about the Marine wanting to go back to who he was is an important one, because people come in with a belief system that the only way they can get better is to get rid of it, and that they are changed forever, and that that's impossible. So what they tell themselves about the trauma is something really crucial to examine. And I often use the image of, you may not go back to who you were, but you may change, but you may not know exactly in what way you're going to be changed. So right now, immediately following the trauma, it's in front of your eyes. It's there constantly, or it's there most of your waking or sleeping life if you're having nightmares. Is it possible to move it to the side? Is it possible to believe that it doesn't always have to be in the forefront of everything that happens to you? And you begin to think about shifting it, giving it meaning, as we said, shifting it into another place, and doing something productive with it, getting some control rather than feeling controlled by the trauma. I think that's really important. And people come in thinking, I've lost control before, there's no way to regain it. And our job is often to show them how to regain control.
How do people do who go through this without the help of a therapist? I'm thinking a lot of people who experience trauma don't get to go to therapy.
Well, a lot of it depends on their natural, as I said, pre-trauma experience, you know, their ability to heal, the support system that they have around them, the early childhood experiences where they have seen people recover from loss and go forward. So I think our natural state for most people is to go back to healing, to go forward, because often we look at people who've been through the most devastating traumas and we can't imagine how they survive to go on and be loving and open and trusting and honest. But it has much to do with who they were before the trauma, and the support they have around them to grow.
Sandra?
I think in addition to what Linda's talked about, I think we have a lot of natural abilities that we often put under the category of creativity. So I think the more people can engage in any kind of artistic, creative pursuit, whatever that is, it may be knitting a sweater, or it might be painting a masterpiece or composing something, but I think that the arts are almost a natural way that we have of promoting healing from within, that have always been in humanity and that still are, but that unfortunately many people now don't feel they are good enough or that they can do anything. And you don't have to do it for a museum. You're doing it to help heal yourself. And that, so that's any kind of spontaneous writing, drama, painting, making anything helps to put the pieces of the brain together, we think, and really can help also bring together more of a sense of community, because you're more likely to do that with, pursue those kinds of things with other people.
And in addition to creative pursuits, you mentioned earlier something you called a survivor mission. And Linda, with the families you worked with who had lost loved ones in the 9/11 attacks, what are some of the missions they have found in their lives?
Oh, definitely working on memorials for their lost loved ones. I had one of the families bring in a collection of photographs because her son happened to be a photographer and he'd taken his favorite pictures of New York City, and she gave me a framed collection of his photographs, and so that was passing him forward, passing his own creation forward and talking about the things that their children had accomplished and how they could carry on the interests and the missions of their kids often was a way. I think the journaling, as Sandy mentioned, I think the writing is crucial because what starts out as a tragedy eventually becomes a story in their lives. So they can tell the story in their lives without re-experiencing the tragedy. And I think those that kept journals, and sometimes journals turned into books, and that was one way they could convert it into a meaningful story without being stuck in the tragedy.
And how do people deal with anniversaries, be it a big anniversary like this one where you hear the constant the coverage on the media everywhere you turn, or personal, private anniversaries, Sandra?
Yeah, I think the private ones are almost more difficult to deal with because you don't necessarily know that you're having an anniversary reaction until you happen to think about it or somebody points it out to you. And what happens to people is that they're more likely to get triggered, to have trouble, maybe some trouble sleeping, or have some memories that are disturbing. You know, the way to deal with it is to deal with it, is to honor the memory, honor the anniversary. Human beings need to do things. Thinking about them usually isn't enough. So that's why when Linda was talking about people memorializing, that's such an important piece. Even if it's an individual tragedy, even if it's a secret loss, to be able to honor it and memorialize it or bury it or burn it or do any of the other ritual kinds of things that human beings have always done to help us move through a transitional space and get to a new place. That, I think, is really the way to deal with anniversaries. Anniversary reactions can be the beginning of opening up a whole new layer of knowing about yourself that you never knew before.
Linda, any thoughts on that in addition?
I just think of how sometimes it can start out as an anniversary and become a celebration of life. And that's what these families would often do, is that they would celebrate the successes of their children along with grieving the loss of the future. But that the joy that they would bring towards just remembering the special, meaningful things of that anniversary time gave them a feeling that they could hold on to their loved one, but not necessarily through sadness, but through joy.
And it seems like doing something is key rather than
yeah.
trying to work it all out inside.
Yes, yeah.
Get
yeah.
out there, be with others,
yes.
and do that kind. We're talking about trauma and recovery, not just in the wake of 9/11, but generally speaking. So if you want to weigh in with a personal story or a remembrance, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. And I'm thinking also, Linda, about the day we talked when Osama bin Laden died. And that was a big day that families had no chance of preparing for, and all of a sudden there was all that media coverage. I know I called a few people who had lost loved ones for reaction, so that must have been also a very tough day on some level.
Yeah, I think it brought up a lot of memories for people and a lot of different reactions. One, a reminder of all that had gone on since then, some enormous relief, some the feeling, well, it was kind of anticlimactic and that was not going to bring back, you know, what they had lost. So there was a lot of variation in people's responses to that.
And Sandy, I've been hearing a lot about something called trauma-informed treatment. And that means that the topic of trauma enters the discussion because I guess a lot of the behaviors we might see in somebody might be because of some prior trauma. Talk a bit about what trauma-informed care is.
I think, yes, you put your finger on it, that up until now, although, you know, we've known in our field that traumas happen, I do not think we had a really rigorous scientific understanding of what that actually meant to the body and the mind and the soul of the person. And now we have over the last couple decades, we've developed a much clearer idea, so much so that we can now look back at many of the problematic behaviors in children and adults that we've diagnosed in the past and just often completely missed the etiology in a previous, often childhood traumatic event that then really screwed up their development and sent them on a pathway that actually it could be quite destructive. So it changes everything. The whole idea of trauma-informed treatment is having the people who are doing the service delivery or the treatment who really understand that, who really understand that they are in the presence of someone who has been injured in some way, that they're not really sick or bad, they're injured. And the key to helping them get on a better pathway to recovery is helping them figure out how to help heal their injury and how to not make it worse.
There's even a link potentially between obesity and prior trauma and cardiac problems.
Yes, there's a strong link between childhood adversity and later health problems, as you said, like obesity, cancer, cardiac disease, the 10 most common causes of death in the United States.
But how could that enter into a conversation? Let's say somebody's having a conversation with their regular doctor that they see.
Their doctor should be doing routine screening, just like you go and your doctor asks your family history about medical problems. The doctors need to be asking the same things about exposure to violence and exposure to other kinds of trauma and adversity, just as a normal part of the medical history. So it doesn't stand out in any way other than that it's part of what we need to know to provide good medical care.
Linda Walsh.
I would even extend that to people who are traumatized by the illnesses and diseases they're struggling with. How often does a physician sit down and say, so what is it like to be you? What is it like to suffer with this? Not just give me your list of symptoms, but how is it affecting your life? How are your relationships with your family members and that kind of thing? And there's one other very interesting thing I think we can do with trauma, and that's sometimes in the telling of it, we can have people who were traumatized as children. I had one woman who was molested by a grandparent, and I asked her if there had been an adult nearby, what could that adult have done? And she said if her grandmother had been nearby, her grandmother was a seamstress, she could have actually sewed, in this child's mind, sewed the molester's hands in his pockets, happened to be her grandfather. So she went back to this early memory as an adult, remembered what it was like to be as a child, and kind of brought in some adult coping mechanisms, and then started to picture the scene again, but this time it was different. This time his hands were sewn in his pockets. Her heart rate slowed down, her breathing relaxed, and she was actually able to alter the early memory using some things she'd grown up with as an adult. So there are many creative things to do.
We're talking about trauma and recovery, and we'll talk more after our break. Our guests are Drs. Linda Welsh and Sandra Bloom. Bloom is a psychiatrist with Drexel University School of Public Health, and Linda Welsh is a therapist and the director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd. We'll also take some phone calls after our break at 1-888-477-9499. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Prostate cancer is second only to skin cancer among U.S. men. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase's Prostate Cancer Risk Assessment Service helps you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of your family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, hearts plus minds.
On the next Fresh Air, three firefighters tell their 9/11 stories. Jay Jonas was on the fourth floor of the World Trade Center's North Tower when it collapsed around him. Ken Haskell lost two brothers who were also firefighters. Retired firefighter Dennis Smith collects their stories and others in his new book, Decade of Hope. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A massive deficit, wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, American leaders at each other's throats. Did Osama bin Laden win? Also, a new Porgy and Bess is getting raves, but the story is problematic for many African Americans, so what's it like to play Porgy today? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about trauma and recovery, and joining us here in the studio are Drs. Linda Welsh and Sandra Bloom. Bloom is a psychiatrist with Drexel University School of Public Health. She's also written Creating Sanctuary Toward the Evolution of Sane Societies, and you're working on a new book called Restoring Sanctuary. Linda Welsh is a therapist and the director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd, and also a clinical associate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Let's take a phone call at 1-888-477-9499. We have Sherry on the line. Hi, Sherry. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. I'm sorry. I apologize if you guys have progressed in the conversation, but I wanted to, because I was calling in and lost contact, but I wanted to speak a little bit about the idea of leaving the traumatic event or halting the process of recovery too quickly. In terms of my daughter, when we left New York City, we sort of had this sense of getting to Bucks County and thinking how angry we were that people weren't experiencing what we were experiencing. It was almost as if we lived in a different world.
So, Sherry, just so we can fill people in, your story was featured in the first hour, and
you were
in New York City with your children on September 11th, and they experienced the entire thing, and then you moved to Bucks County, but people there had a totally different experience. So that must have felt very isolating.
Yeah, it really was, and it wasn't until I realized that my daughter just stop talking about the event altogether, and then every year, and it sort of connects to the idea of what anniversaries are like. A big reason why I decided to let my kids do the interview is because I wanted to give them some control over the process of what happens every year around this time. You know, they go to school, they have well-meaning teachers and people who want to talk about it in class, and you know, because it was a historic event. But the people who experience the event firsthand are often left to feel powerless, like it's all happening to them, as opposed to them taking some control over their recovery process. And I saw that a lot with my daughter, and it's probably because of the age that she was at the time.
Yeah, Sandra, why don't you weigh in on that? And Linda, what role does that age play?
I think the younger the child, the more the impact is impacting them at critical developmental times. But I think what Sherry is addressing in terms of feeling like no one really can understand is so on target. And 9/11 was a particularly widespread kind of awareness, and many people were affected by that. But for so many children, their experiences of adversity are very private, often very secret, and they are utterly alone with that experience. And they do often feel that no one can understand, and that puts them outside of their ability to benefit from a healing community. And you do need to have people who can really understand what you've been through in order to really feel that sense of wholeness and being with people that really get what it was like, that you don't have to explain every detail over and over again.
Linda? Right.
Yeah,
right.
And Sherry's comment about giving the children an opportunity to take control, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't know if Sandy would agree with this or not, but I think that the most salient feature of a trauma is our feeling of no control. And if in any way we can take control by telling someone about it, by doing something with it, by giving it meaning, by hitting a doll with a bat, whatever gives you back a sense of control, gives you back a feeling like, okay, the world is in totally chaotic, totally unpredictable, and kids particularly can feel like they've lost all control having gone through something like that. And just being able to be recognized for what they went through, again, gives them this, I've regained control. I now am the storyteller, and I am back in a position of not just the victim, but the survivor.
Thank you so much for that call, Sherry. And Sandra, you mentioned the children who are experiencing horrific things in almost in secret. Nobody knows. Who could reach those children?
Well, they signal their distress to us. They do it in school. They do it at home. They do it in the neighborhood. They do it all over the place. But often by behavior that is problematic. So that we tend to label the child and expect them to straighten up and fly right, when really the child is signaling there's something wrong. Something's happened to me that's really bad, and this is the only way. I have no words for it. I can't express myself. I can only do it through my behavior. So that's that whole issue of trauma-informed approaches. It's really recognizing that when a human being behaves in some way that is outside of a social norm, that it's time to respond to that as a signal that something's wrong and I need help.
And Linda, what do teachers, for example, know about trauma? I'm thinking sexual abuse, physical abuse at home.
What they don't know is the question. I think it's a major concern how often, Sandy said, kids are labeled as problems rather than understood as expressions of some trauma that they're experiencing. There was a youngster that I saw in treatment who was in trouble at school for lying and labeled as this kid tells lies. Well, what was going on was he was so frightened of a lot of the things that were happening in his household and whether he would tell the truth about it, that he just figured my best coping skill is to make up stories and to tell lies about things. And that was somehow lost in the label of he tells lies and he's a child with a problem, and we have to now see him as the problem and not look at the family system and understand what purpose his behavior is serving him at that point. And usually it's one of protection. How can I protect myself?
Let's take another call. We have Marley on the line from West Philadelphia. Hi, Marley. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because about 4 years ago, I witnessed my partner commit suicide. And I was seeing a therapist and doing traditional talk therapy, and it just wasn't addressing one thing in particular, which was that I was having flashbacks. And because of that, the therapist suggested that I do body work to try to help loosen my body up so that I could address that issue. And I went through a series of acupuncture treatments. And through that, I was actually able to address that and haven't had a flashback since my last treatment, which has been almost 3 years. So I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts about how non-traditional therapies can also help in the healing process for post-traumatic stress and trauma.
Thank you, Marley, for that call. Sandra, what is your reaction?
Yes.
Yes.
Good. Thanks for calling, Marley. That's a very good example, because I'm sure there are people listening and going, acupuncture, how could that help you reduce flashbacks? And yet there's much more that we don't know about the way the mind works than that we do know about the way the mind works. And there's no question that alternative approaches can be very helpful in helping people somehow inside put together fragments of experience that are continuing to haunt them and help them to recover and heal. And we know we have some studies about yoga being really helpful. We have a body of work about something that's called eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And there's probably it's probably going to end up that there are lots of modalities that can help people to heal using all different routes that modern medicine does not yet properly respect.
And Linda, it also seems like it could be different things at different times.
Oh, yes, and for different individuals. People will respond to the eye movement desensitization. Other people will find it very uncomfortable. But what I think is amazing is we've discovered that there are so many places in our body that lodge memory. It may be a pain in the neck, you know, which turns out to be associated with a stress or a memory that one has. And just by relaxing and relieving the tension and the stress through massage, all of a sudden there's a clearing of the head and the area that carries the pain. So I think every minuscule part of our body collectively has all the information that we need to know what hurts. And there's so many ways to get at that. And as I said, for different people, there's going to be different avenues. And a lot of it has to do with going in and being open to exploring what that avenue is for that particular person.
Let's take another call. We have Emily from Ardmore joining us. Hi, Emily. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I just wanted to actually comment. I experienced a very traumatic accident, or, well, we're not quite sure if it was an accident or a suicide, but a man did walk in front of traffic in front of the art museum about 2 years ago, and I was, like, the first person there, and I called the ambulance, and he did die. But I just wanted to say that, like, afterwards, I started therapy, and I actually ended up being committed to a psychiatric facility. And most people are very, like, against it still, but if it works for you, I don't know. I don't see why there should be any stigma against it, because if I wouldn't have went, honestly, I don't know what I would have done.
And how are you now?
You know what? I'm doing great. I haven't been to the art museum. I hadn't been to the art museum since the accident, and I actually went Saturday, and I went to, like, the scene and stuff, and it was very easy. I didn't think it was going to be. But I was an art history major, and I dropped out of school shortly after the accident, and I hadn't been to any museum since it happened. It was that traumatic for me. But yes, through therapy and, you know, my stay in the hospital and, you know, and the support from others, I'm able to now to walk in front of a museum, which I haven't been able to do.
And do you talk to others about that experience to let them know also that?
I feel like, to an extent, I don't want pity, though, and it's hard for me to talk about it and my emotions towards it. So I don't really talk to others with the exception of, like, my family and my therapist.
Thank you so much, Emily, for that call. Sandra, any thoughts on that?
Well, it's nice to hear that Emily had a positive experience in a psychiatric setting, and because it really can be very helpful. We had a program for 20 years, and it was an inpatient treatment program for trauma survivors, and it was, I think, extraordinarily helpful when people get really stuck and it gets worse and worse and they have a downward spiral. Then that's a way to kind of stop it from spiraling down and create a community for people, right, who are all experiencing the same thing. But there are very few resources left because of what's happened in our behavioral health system for people who have those kind of problems to come for any length of time. What we really need are those kinds of healing centers. It wouldn't necessarily have to be a hospital, but places where people can go who are just, you know, can't move any further without more intensive help. And then as Emily describes, she's getting better, and she can now at least walk in front of the museum, and I think will probably be in one soon. It's really important to, again, as Linda's been talking about, respond to what the individual needs.
Linda?
It amazes me, and yet it doesn't, that Emily starts out by saying there's still a stigma against seeking mental health resources, no matter what you've been through. But yet there's not a stigma for taking medications now because everybody's using Prozac and whatever. And so you go to your doctor and you say, okay, I'm having nightmares, I'm having trouble sleeping, and well, give you the medication, and you know, you, six of your friends already know about it. But yet to seek help, to sit down and have a conversation with someone about the pain that you experienced and the lingering effects of it, that's still looked upon, frowned upon, and it's a sad state that all these years later, that's what's happening still.
And it seems like the topic and issue of trauma and its huge impact on people's health and mental health is entering the conversation on a broader level than it ever has been. But I would think the biggest concern are those children and those people who really have no access to resources.
Oh, yes.
Poverty, violence, all of those things.
Yeah. It's a huge problem because of the magnitude of the exposure to violence that kids are exposed to at home, at school, in the community, in the impoverished areas of Philadelphia. We have a huge public health issue around violence.
Linda, any closing thoughts on that?
Only that, you know, shows like this that bring public awareness for the need to pay more attention to why there is violence and why these young people who take life with little meaning because they live in these violent areas and how much attention they need to be given is just incredibly important.
And Sandra, I know we just have a few seconds left, but sometimes it seems like everything comes down to trauma, but that's an overstatement, but a lot of things do.
Yeah, well, it's an underlying shift in moving from viewing people as sick or bad to viewing them as injured, and that is a monumental shift for all of our service delivery systems.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Our guests have been Drs. Linda Welsh and Sandra Bloom. Bloom is a psychiatrist with Drexel University School of Public Health and has also written Creating Sanctuary Toward the Evolution of Sane Societies. Linda Welsh is a therapist and the director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd, and she's also a clinical associate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Our engineer for the show has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.